How do we optimize costs? How do we optimize value? How do we drive through innovation with supply chains? How do we bring the answers in advance to our colleagues, to our stakeholders, to the board, and be more proactive in terms of the next opportunity that's there within automation or robotics or whatever it may be. But you know, markets are changing, subsectors are changing. It's actually being almost like a fairly elite financial analyst at the table predicting from a supply market point of view and a supplier point of view which ones to bet on and why.
Welcome to the Procurement Initiative Leaders Podcast, the ultimate resource for top-level procurement professionals looking to stay ahead of the curve and drive meaningful change within their organizations. I'm your host, Richard McIntosh, partner at H&Z, Europe's leading procurement consultancy. Join me as I sit down with global leaders in procurement to uncover the latest trends, strategies, and insights that are shaping the future of procurement. We tackle crucial topics like leadership, technology, value creation, cost management, supply chain resilience, and many more. Ready to up your game as a leader in procurement? Let's jump into this episode of the Procurement Initiative Leaders Podcast with me, Richard McIntosh. Today, Kath Harmston joins me on the show. Kath is a non-executive director, wealth of board level experience, and also has taken and led a number of procurement transformations. So a real pleasure, Kath, to have you on the show. You've had some big procurement roles in the past, and you've taken on some big challenges. So would you mind giving the podcast listeners a little feel for your CV?
Sure. I started off life as a research chemist, and after that, I took on a bridging role between procurement and research. Mm-hmm. And that's how I got into procurement, by the way, is decoding the commercial requirements for a research department. I then moved into, so my operational procurement roles were with BASF and Philips, mm-hmm. in the electronics and chemical industry.
Yep.
And I had the opportunity to move into consulting. Mm-hmm. And I joined KPMG Consultant as a project director, specializing in procurement and supply chain, and being responsible for their methodologies and helping clients out. So I had the benefit of working with lots and lots of different clients. Mm-hmm. Including the Ministry of Defence.
Yes.
The Ministry of Defence was a really interesting case study because it was £24 billion of spend at DES, spanning over 300 clients' involvement in the project and over 100 consultants.
Wow.
It was a three-year programme, and we managed to deliver a significant number of billions of pounds of savings and innovation. We achieved the Management Consulting Awards for that. So I was part of a team who was award-winning, and it was wonderful just to be inspired by like-minded individuals and have fun whilst doing that and learning on the ground. I then became a managing partner for Attus Consulting that had taken over KPMG Consulting, heading up the defence sector and specialising in procurement and supply chain. And in my early 40s, decided that I should learn what it's like to be a procurement officer on the other side of the fence. So I jumped over into the CPO role for the Royal Mail Group just prior to privatization and a quasi-public sector organization that was bound by a lot of red tape and a lot of regulations. Mm-hmm. I was really keen to see how we could manage change and take it up to a good status, a world-class status. And I was privileged to be part of an absolutely fabulous team that was nominated for Best in Class and had platinum accreditation by 2013.
Great.
We are also award-winning in terms of our efforts of what we did and achieved there. Mm-hmm. And we had a 2.3 billion cost base, 28,000 suppliers, and were able to take out a significant amount of cost reduction over a five-year period. And that was at the time where Moya Green, or Dame Moya Green, joined. She joined in just in 2010-11.
Yes.
And she was a huge sponsor of mine in terms of the change program that resulted after that. Great. So we were able to, the team was able to deliver £300 million savings in 6 months on a cost base of £2.3 billion. So I cut my teeth on an executive role in the Royal Mail. I took on a CPO role for the Co-op Group, which was a short-term experience for me. And after that, I was also a non-exec director for the Ministry of Defence, DNS, with a large portfolio, and able to see things from a different perspective. So being a an executive is very different to a non-exec in terms of the roles and responsibilities. I was part of the Risk and Audit Committee, as well as the main board. And it was a huge opportunity to actually get insight from that perspective. Since then, I've grown my portfolio. I'm an advisory board member for Breaking Barriers Innovations now, that look after socioeconomic challenges in the UK. I'm a fractional C-suite interim, as they call it now, which means I actually provide support and short-term offset for chief execs or chief procurement officers if they need 1 or 2 days a week decompression, or think about strategic aspects or manage day-to-day activities. I do that. So I've got a balanced portfolio of non-exec work as well as exec. I get involved in projects as well, so maybe startups, mergers and acquisitions. And so I've got a much broader base of activity now than just procurement alone. But my passion and my heart lies in procurement and supply chain, always will. I actually volunteer in palliative care. I actually am a member, a freeman of the Worshipful Company of Educators in London. So I get involved in all sorts of activities around education and the development of leaders for the future.
Excellent. Well, Kath, thank you and welcome to the show. Let's talk about what you see happening at board level, because it's really interesting, the outlook for 2024. And then we can drop into how does procurement fit into that?
Interesting, from what I'm seeing at the board level, is they really have an appetite to understand how procurement can add value and how a procurement plays its part in the delivery of goals and objectives for the coming year, but also the 3 and 5 year plan. Interestingly, I picked up a couple of articles out there from KPMG and SAP, and the stats say it all, really. So 77% of execs say they cannot access good spend data real time.
Okay, that's a surprise.
50% of execs say they cannot find alternative sources quickly enough. 42% experience reconciliation issues. 37% say processes are semi-automated or manual. 41% say they find adoption of systems difficult, so the P2P or business management system. 47% believe they're vulnerable to disruption upstream, to cost and labour crises. Makes sense. 43% say they don't have visibility to their supply chains down to tier four. And 53% say inflation will impact supply chains longer term. So they're the kind of questions that are going on at the boardroom right now, apart from profitability and EBITDA, of course. I mean,
take that for granted.
But it's how accessible is this service? How user-friendly are the systems? How quickly and agile are you as a service to respond to the geopolitical issues, perhaps the supply chain issues that we've got, inflationary changes, and innovation? It's almost like there is a pull environment now at the board after COVID and the pandemic. But there's kind of like a gap, an airlock in between what the procurement officer is decoding the mission and goals and objectives to be and how they're received at board level. So I think that's for CPOs out there to really take that on board and be more prescriptive and actually talk about what the challenges are.
Yeah.
What they can do with the budgets that they have, and be open and honest about, you know, the shopping list of must do versus can do versus should do.
There's I mean, it's interesting. There's an assumption there that procurement functions have this under control. You know, there's an assumption that we have spend visibility. There's an assumption that we have supplier visibility down to tier four. And also the interesting one there about the systems that we have this, you know, suite of systems available to us. So quite interesting that's what they in a way expect. And then of course, then it's the challenge of translating their strategy into what's possible from a function perspective.
Yeah. And, you know, systems, they're only as good as what you put in. Poor data in equals poor information out. And so, you know, it's how well they're integrated into the organization, how we train and educate not just the procurement staff, but actually the users. Yeah. And how agile are these systems? Are they portable? Can you dial in on a mobile? Do you understand why the preferred suppliers have been chosen and what they're doing for your budget and for the rest of your colleagues? So if you've got a large-scale organization with many different business divisions and many budget holders, they'll want to know why we're choosing this supplier over their preferred suppliers. It's a fairly, you know, reasonable question to ask. Why should we be choosing supplier A when we could be using supplier B? And if you've got a dashboard of readily, easily consumable information about what's available to you, why you should choose that, and an easy flow of the system and process, it makes for better customer satisfaction, which is an important KPI, by the way.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, fact-based decision making, isn't it? Taking away that that emotive decision making, and it based on a full range of data that's available to you.
Yeah. And it's not going to be perfect by any means, but having spend per supplier, per business unit, per budget, per category, real time, that's relatively accurate, and having an understanding of your third party liabilities, particularly in difficult financial times, it's really important. So if the chief financial officer gives you a call and says, hey, where are we at with our total liabilities and how much are we spending on X, Y, and Z, then not being able to access that and have a representative, meaningful report quickly is a nightmare.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Kath, I wanted to just go back and take it back. We talked about systems a bit there, but take it back to that board level expectation. That kind of the core proposition of procurement being value, driving value for the business. So just wanted to get your thoughts on, what do you see procurement's value add in 2024 and the 3-year plan?
Right. So, I mean, for me, there are five key things on the agenda. The first one is agility and digital readiness. How quick are we to adapt to issues, challenges, need to change suppliers around, challenges in geopolitical circumstances and so on? How protected is our supply base? And how up to speed and up to date are we with AI, you know, the trends in automation, and how can we be ready for that?
Yes.
How user-friendly are we? Next one is profitability. And it's moving away from did cost to should cost.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Third one, which is a bit of a curveball, but it's a necessary one, particularly for businesses who are trading over £500 million and have over 500 staff, they must report on ESG.
Yes.
A sustainability, concurrence, audit trails. What are we doing in the supply chain to make that an end-to-end, clean, clear, safe process? But that requires a different skill set And it requires a lot of attention to detail in terms of qualifying suppliers, understanding right down to tier four what we're doing, how we're doing it, being able to report on that, to audit that, and to have clarity in how that affects supplier selection processes and category strategies. So that's big on the agenda, not just giving lip service, by the way. Yeah. And it often is. It's just, have we ticked the box?
Have we met our quotas?
Yeah, you know,
the research that's coming out of the procurement initiative is backing that up completely. That it's, you know, it's still top of the agenda. It's still being discussed, but then you've got this gap between what's being talked about and really what's happening. And that gap's got to be bridged. And a procurement function's got to step into that and provide that. You know, firstly, the compliance aspect, as you said there, the ESG reporting, and then there's actually the impact of it. You know, how do we build that into our selection criteria? How do we build it into our supplier management? How do we begin to compete based on that requirement?
Exactly, and more importantly, what does that cost us over and above?
Yeah,
the basic workload of tendering, contract management, supplier relationship management, market analyses, stakeholder and supplier communications, and so on and so forth. So it's an extra, very important piece of work that requires slightly different skill sets to that which we normally attribute to procurement and supply chain. And segregating that out and attributing return on investment for that is quite an important thing to, you know, a bit of work to do in order to put the focus light on and say, yes, it must be done. Why must it be done? And why? What does it reveal? What does it give us? Fourth one on the agenda was risk reduction. So I often get this conversation at board level that says, look, we don't want to understand the rear view mirror of what's happened, albeit that's important. Mm-hmm. So who are our key suppliers? How did they perform? How much are they at risk? What's their solvency status? You know, have we got the right partners? What are we doing about critical suppliers? Are we finding alternatives? And so alternative sources of supply, but actually reducing the risk within the supply chains and making sure we have adequate sources for demand for the foreseeable future and being able to, with agility, move into a different direction if need be. And there's a lot of bounce back from the pandemic of, are we ready? Are we proactive? So boards are saying, hang on a minute, I want the front view, forward-looking, proactive, predictive view of each, the top 20, for example, and the critical suppliers. And more importantly, when it comes to partnering and collaboration and so on with a vital few, they're as important to us as what our staff are, our employees.
Yes.
How are we treating them?
Yeah.
Are we evaluating their risks equally as we would ours internally? Mm-hmm. So it's actually looking at resource pools, whether they be external or internal, as almost one and the same.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And that's a different view, you know, that's a view where, you know, if you do look at pre-COVID, you know, risk and resilience wasn't high up on the agenda. And of course, you know, it's, you know, lockdown, and the instability of supply chains has suddenly brought that onto the agenda. And I don't know, what's your thoughts there of procurement functions just got used to managing the instability and the inflation, or do we have to do more now?
Well, I think it's settling colleagues down that we've got everything under control, that there's more to do, but the basics and the adaptability and the agility and the responsiveness is there. Yeah. So we can demonstrate our 3-point plan should X, Y, or Z kick into place. And we've got, you know, 2 years of experience now under our belts to do that.
Yeah.
The fifth one actually is innovation and drive-through. So how are we going to help a business innovate, differentiate itself within the marketplace and get that competitive advantage? So they're the five.
Yeah.
And they all actually are codependent and they intermesh. But from my point of view, how are we going to avoid cost, optimize the cost that we have? Mm-hmm. And there are great examples of organizations still cost reducing, even though they are developed in their procurement yes. organizations, through inflationary periods. So we can't necessarily rely on the old, chestnut of cost reduction to get us through as the tagline or the strapline of what procurement does anymore.
Yeah.
It is, how do we optimize costs? How do we optimize value? How do we drive through innovation with supply chains? How do we bring the answers in advance to our colleagues, to our stakeholders, to the board, and be more proactive in terms of the next, opportunity that's there within automation or robotics or whatever it may be. But, you know, markets are changing, subsectors are changing. It's actually being almost like a fairly elite financial analyst at the table predicting from a supply market point of view and a supplier point of view which ones to bet on and why.
Absolutely. So that's a really interesting one, because I love this subject, which is around that, you know, what's the type of person that you need in your procurement function that can do that? You know, because we're talking about a big difference between a tactical buyer who's, you know, focused on quick negotiation, which is maybe, you know, looking back where lots of the cost reduction came from in the past, to someone who's, you know, has got that strategic capability to do exactly as you've just talked about there, to spot the trend, to understand supplier capability and innovation in a supply market, and then bring that forward and bring it into the corporate radar.
Yeah, I've seen, you know, having had 30 plus years in the field, I've seen this trend of moving away from commodity specific, very narrow vertical experts.
Yes.
To almost, if you like, athletes who, you know, who can actually project manage, they can collaborate, they can manage conflict, they can be the bridge and the advocate between the supplier and stakeholders. They have to be predictors, they have to be analysts, they have to be far ahead of the technology. So there are lots of arguments for we should have a smaller number of those type of individuals as we automate
yes.
and become more comfortable with artificial intelligence and optimize our systems. We should have strategically placed individuals across the business, within the business,
yeah.
to advise, to counsel, to be there as almost like a procurement concierge. With a great backup system that allows the right information at the right time, with the yes. right clarity and with the right rationale for why things are the way they are right now, from a category management perspective and a category strategy perspective, and how they could change.
Yeah.
So we're talking, it's almost like a parity or a peer equivalent that we're moving into now, where we've got someone who has the ability to be multilingual in the business sense of speaking yeah. with their finance partners, their technical partners, their IT partners, and of course the suppliers as well, and bringing that pool of high intensity resource together for something far greater than they alone could manage themselves.
Yes. Yeah.
And that skill is something that we're trying to build on and grow, because what once used to be the cost reducing negotiator has now moved into something far more elite.
Yes. Yes. Well, you're talking about a, you know, high impact, you know, internal consultants, effectively, you know, they're able to facilitate, they're able to operate at a high level, as you say, almost at board level, and have those meaningful discussions around functional strategy, business requirements, and translate that into impact. Mm. But so here's an interesting question. How do you get to that? You know, there's always this discussion around, you know, you've led some big procurement transformations, so I'm kind of interested mm-hmm. in how you can really do it. But, you know, can you take a function forward from that operational tactical position to a far more strategic capability, because you've still got business as usual to do whilst you're making that change?
And the answer is yes. It's not easy.
Yeah, of course.
But it is absolutely achievable. And I would start with the fundamental point of sponsorship.
Yeah.
Because any CPO is going to face a change challenge and an ongoing change challenge as well.
Yeah.
The average change cycle for a procurement function is about 7 years.
Yeah.
If you're starting from, a very low base and then moving to, high performing integrated functions within the business. So it's a long journey.
It is. Yeah.
And, the operational and tactical roles are necessary. Mm-hmm. They're valued. And they're the bread and butter and the underpinning foundation of any procurement organization. Mm-hmm. They're needed. And it is absolutely okay to identify those individuals, give them accolade, because they don't necessarily want to be involved in the change. Mm-hmm. And actually segregating out those that wish to go on a change journey and those who wish to do business as usual, and almost separate out. Mm-hmm. Those two types of skills,
yep.
And find some sort of a boundary where they overlap, is the skill set for the CPO. But without sponsorship to start off with and getting board buy-in,
yep.
I'm afraid a change journey is almost impossible.
Absolutely, absolutely. And from your experience, how have you gone about getting that board sponsorship?
Well, it starts off, interestingly, at the recruitment stage of the CPO position. And I've made some mistakes along the way in terms of my selections in the past, and I've made some really good choices as well.
Yeah.
And it's actually it's almost like trying something on for size and saying, well, how does this fit? Yeah. Are my goals and my personal objectives aligned with this company's need and thirst for change? I'm a change agent. Yeah. I'm not interested in a business as usual organization. I want to take on those ugly, gnarly challenges.
You love a challenge.
I love a challenge and move them forward. So it's testing out right at the beginning.
Yeah.
Is the CEO on board? Is the CFO on board?
Yeah.
How do your other peer colleagues feel about procurement as a function? Yeah. And kind of evaluating the readiness for change in an organization.
Yes.
And the appetite for it. If you've got that, then you're halfway there. The next stage is being able to gather very, very quickly, less than 90 days, what is the situational analysis? Taking the problem to them. Not hiding behind it and not promising the world and saying, yes, you can have it all. You can have the change program. You can have the business as usual. Everything's going to be hunky-dory and you're going to get your cost reduction at the end of the year.
Yeah.
That is a recipe for disaster, in my opinion, and it can lead to all sorts of issues, not just for yourself as a leader, but for staff who are at the end of that really interesting
conversation. Yes.
You have to deal with that and detangle it.
Absolutely, yeah. Because at the end of the day, they're at the coalface, and that's the challenge. And it's so interesting to be, what you're saying there is being very realistic about, where the function is now, where the organization is right now, and of course having that vision and that mission, but then being realistic and pragmatic about what's actually required on that journey.
Yeah, other things that have worked for me in the past is actually taking executive teams to procurement departments that are working at full throttle, are the best of the best, that are mature, or getting a CPO to come from another organization to the board meeting and presenting what good looks like.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
Other ways of doing it are simply just being very candid about the problem statement, mm-hmm. being very simple in your delivery of what the solutions can be, and being very clear what the return on investment and the costs are going to be.
Yeah.
And sadly, having the conversation with yourself in the small hours of the morning that says, which people in my department have the skills for change, which have the skills for business as usual,
yeah,
who will survive the change journey and who won't.
Yeah, absolutely key. Yeah, I mean, it is being honest and realistic about that challenge, because everyone isn't going to change.
No, and being frank with yourself and the board is an important stage, but also being frank with the team that you are going to go through a change. Mm-hmm. It is going to be difficult. It is going to be scary. It is going to be challenging.
Yeah.
But not asking them to continually do business as usual as well as change. That is the most draining and demotivating thing a leader can do ultimately. For short spans, it's fine.
Yep.
But for longer spans, you end up with a battle-weary team who resent you.
Yeah, yeah. And that's not sustainable, is it?
No, it's not.
And interesting, going back to your point about the length of that change journey, it's not a, there can sometimes be an expectation that you can go from operational to strategic in 18 months, 2 years, but it's a long journey, isn't it, to get to excellence. So you've got to have that sustainability and the people go on that journey.
I think, being realistic with oneself, because for me, I've got a large appetite for change and I love it.
Yeah.
And it doesn't scare me. And, I'm quite innovative and I've got that ability to work through adversity and deal with ambiguity. But that's my skill set. It's not everyone's.
Yeah.
Getting quick wins, showing the team what they can do and be part of it and celebrating that success and then drip feeding those wins into the board is absolutely vital.
Yes.
That will give more confidence. It will give more feedback and it certainly will serve you well a budgeting round the following year.
Absolutely.
So don't overpromise, don't underpromise. And it's a skill to be able to balance out what the art of the possible is and then deliver on it, particularly if your systems aren't up to scratch and your integration within the business and your sponsorship within the business is poor. I think there's nothing more refreshing than a chief exec and an executive team looking to procurement and saying, look, come with us, with the business, for the business, invite you in to the party and get you to work on the problems together and report the solutions and the results together.
Yeah, absolutely. I love the idea of the flywheel analogy where, you try not to boil the ocean, take something, make a success of it, make that visible and earn the right to then go and do it again, go a little bit deeper the next time. You keep putting up those wins because that's what will drive the positive change.
Yeah, another tactic of mine that I've used quite regularly that's been quite successful actually is having a capacity analysis to hand.
Mm-hmm.
So knowing what your team is capable of in terms of operational, tactical and strategic roles.
Yeah.
Looking at the tasks at hand that the business is asking you and creating what you can do versus what the business is asking you to do.
Yeah, yeah.
And on that basis, you can have a really meaningful conversation to say, look, if your shopping list is 20 items, Mr. Finance Officer or Ms. Finance Officer, I can only cover off 8 with the capacity load that I have.
Yeah.
What would you like to do? How would you like to prioritize? Now, if you want to do all the 20 items, it's going to cost you X.
Yeah.
And the return on investment is Y. Mm-hmm. And, we can make sure it's delivered on time in full.
Yeah.
So having that to hand and having that as a almost like a compelling yet encouraging conversation with them to say, look, it is possible. We're not saying it can't be done, but with what I have, this is what I can do meaningfully for you.
That's it. Yeah, yeah. You're able to talk about the realistic constraints. And I guess that develops on into almost a dashboard of kind of having that ability to discuss and prioritize with the board what should be worked on first.
Yeah. And moving that into the projects that, that you have on the wheel. Mm-hmm. So understanding what your capacity is in terms of man hours, what the actual base load of work is and what the project work is. Mm-hmm. And then pulling that into one analysis and saying, look, you know, I've got X man hours capability, yep. And we're going to cut off at, you know, project 11.
Yep.
And projects 12 through 20 are lost opportunities.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And now do you want to do that or not? Mm-hmm. Or do you want to fund it through additional resourcing, whether that be temporary or permanent?
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, there's a change program running in parallel with that too.
Yeah.
And this is how much that's going to require in terms of manpower and funding.
Yeah.
So it's being very precise on what your business as usual is going to be able to deliver, what your additional projects and cost reduction activities are going to be able to deliver, and any change programs over and above that.
Yeah.
From a capacity and a return on investment point of view.
Yes. Yeah, great. And yeah, love that. We're not promising the world. We've been quite clear as to what's achievable, and you can then put the time frame to that. Just to go a little bit deeper into that, because there's a really interesting, I guess, as a CPO, you've got options now, because we've got so much automation and digitization available to us. Mm. And almost touching back to one of your earlier points, which was around, you know, can we effectively use automation to do some of the more process tasks, and therefore have the chance to use those strategic athletes and collaborative internal consultants to make the big impact. So how do you see that sort of play of team versus automation and digital processes?
You know, I'm all for it.
Yeah.
I think the more we can automate the repetitive, grinding, you know, demotivating tasks, the better for us.
Yeah.
As a function. But is reducing headcount the same as reducing cost? Mm-hmm. So it might be that you automate, you get mm-hmm. you reap the rewards of that, and you've got excess staff. Now, do you redeploy
mm-hmm.
or do you reduce and cut the headcount?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Or do you say to the board, that which I've saved in headcount, I wish to now reinvest in more athletes or the elite team to actually do more for you rather than less. So there seems to be this assumption that why don't we just cut headcount across the board and it'll all be fine? Why would you cut an engine of cost reduction, cost improvement, innovation and collaboration and risk management? Why would you cut that down when you can actually have more?
Exactly.
And that's really my argument. Sometimes there is a clear argument for, and sometimes there is against, and you just have to accept what that is. But for me, I often go in with, well, I've been asked to reduce headcount, but is that really the question?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that can be a short-term CFO outlook of looking at the cost of the procurement function, rather than going back to
the value
of the delivered.
And it
can come back to that CPO challenge again of painting the vision of you know, what does good look like? And, you know, I love your point about taking a board to show them an excellent function, because sometimes you just don't know. A board doesn't know what value a good procurement function can bring.
I think sharing procurement functions of supply organizations is really quite interesting as well.
Yeah.
And having a collaboration forum where, you know, a board comes along to the CPOs of all of the top 20 suppliers.
Yep. That's an interesting concept.
I mean, that is really interesting, you know.
Yeah.
And talking about the business challenges and the market challenges as a round table, that's got to be something that is really worth value.
Yeah.
But it's almost a CPO should have and be able to have, and, you know, I know it's not always easy, those vital statistics at their fingertips to say, what have I got? What capacity do I have? What can I achieve? What can't I achieve? What's my return? What can I do for you? What's going wrong at the moment? How can we move forward? And having statistics available now, if you've got the automated systems, they're going to give you real-time reports that can show a dashboard that can actually help you educate your stakeholders. If you don't, it's we've all been there with the spreadsheets. Absolutely. I'm not going to go into that, but it's well worth the midnight oil to get to those points where you can seamlessly talk about your challenges and your issues, plus what you can do if only you were allowed to, if the gates were opened. And so for me, I welcome automation. I welcome AI. I picked up a really interesting little tidbit the other day. Yeah. ChatGPT's IQ is 155. Einstein's IQ was 160.
Yep.
So that's the current version of ChatGPT. Now, the rate of automation and AI at the moment, we are going to have the pleasure of seeing an absolute boom over the next 5 years, you know, to a point where it will be expected that our staff will be able to keep up with all of the trends that AI automation can provide us with, but interpret that as well.
Yes. Yeah.
And decode it and simplify it and influence with it.
Yeah.
So I think it's a fabulous opportunity to create strategic influencers in the business and possibly get extra resources or extra funding for those individuals who could do more innovation as a cost reduction, as a result of cost reduction from the overhead reduction that you've had previously due to automation.
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to experience an incredible time of change. Because you know AI, machine learning will put this information at our fingertips, but of course it then comes back to the the interpretation of that, and the ability to synthesize that information and make an impact in the business. It comes back to those high performing commercial individuals who can do that. If we've automated we're providing them with incredible tools, but we still need those people to make the impact.
Yes. And you know, it's almost like any one point in time, your team should be able to articulate its goals and objectives against the business's goals and objectives and be able to cite the value add that's happening real time.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and celebrate it, and for stakeholders to be able to celebrate with them because they know they've been involved in that. Yes. So I'm moving towards this concept of how do we get procurements involved in the business and connected with the business and celebrated and recognized as a joint effort.
Yeah. Well, you know, we've always gone back to that essential need for stakeholder engagement. You know, good procurement comes from engaging with the stakeholders, and it is, you know, it's collaboration that is key to drive that. You know, you can be great at buying, but that's very different from actually, you know, being able to bring a category strategy together or to, you know, deliver a, you know, real business requirements.
I've watched this painful and prohibitive process move to something that is powerful, proactive, and predictive.
Yeah.
And that's really where we want to be. We don't want to be seen as the, the purchase order police.
Yes.
And oftentimes we are. In some organizations, there's still that stigma.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's for the CPOs of the future to address and stand tall on and demonstrate what good looks like. So it's really all there for the taking, particularly if you've got a good business management system or an adequate optimized P2P system, because the two are different now, and understanding how you can move forward with your stakeholders and your suppliers. And if you like, piercing the veil between the supplier and the stakeholder and getting automated collaborative processes underway and bring very, very, very simple but effective collaborative mechanisms together and get new product to market quickly, which is really what it's all about.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to ask you about that. That's just going back to one of the 5 points you mentioned at the beginning about, you know, being able to linking that corporate strategy to innovation. You know, so how how to bring in the innovation from suppliers and the supply market into the organization. And you talked a little bit about that, about kind of that you know, that collaboration and that connectivity.
Yeah, sadly, the suppliers do find and continue to find it difficult to actually access a business.
Yes. Yep. Yep.
From the simple things of, can I just please speak to someone who is a decision maker? Mm-hmm. Through to when are the next bids coming out, to I've got some great ideas, who will hear me on it, mm-hmm. to you know, where are we in terms of awareness on your supplier relationship management system? Are we a preferred supplier and why?
Yes.
Why not? Down to contract management, simple contract management. So how do we get a supplier to be innovative? Mm-hmm. How do we optimize what they've got to offer? Mm-hmm. Well, we make time to categorize them. We make time to connect them into cross-functional teams. And we continually communicate and we bring the ideas to the table and we launch new products from that and innovations from that. And we connect our return on investment and our benefits analysis to it. Mm-hmm. So it's supplier relationship management is a real passion of mine. And I think that's where it's at going forward, particularly for the more advanced and mature organizations. That's where they've got to spend the majority of their time now.
Yes.
Is once they've settled their supply base down, they've categorized it, they've segmented it, mm-hmm. and so on. Then it's about, you know, bringing it that to life, not just giving it lip service and say, oh, you're a preferred supplier. Yes. It's having real time information about how they're performing, understanding their businesses better than what they do themselves. Mm-hmm. Because oftentimes that's in reverse.
Yep.
The suppliers know more about you than you do about them.
Yep. Yep.
Treating them as external resources.
Yes.
And as part of the resource pool. And keeping them to task about, you know, the latest developments and what they can do.
Yep.
Plus, you creating a bridge into the executive where there is a space on the agenda once a quarter for innovation, particularly with the speed of automation and development that there is right now. You know, we need to start keeping up. So that's the way forward. And getting stakeholders, particularly at exec level, sponsored into owning certain supplier relationships from the top down. So when it gets into contract management, understanding what's happening with the contracts, how they're performing and so on. But there's far more to supplier relationships than that.
Yeah.
It's about predicting where they'll be, how they're going to take us with them, and how we get preferential treatment from them as a result of being a dedicated customer.
Brilliant. You've just given the case for supplier relationship management in a nutshell. Brilliant.
Something that I could go on about for a long time. And believe me, I've had painful experiences about presenting dashboards to executive teams.
Yeah.
What do you mean? Why is this red? Why is this green? Yeah. What does that mean? What's that? Having thousands of contracts per supplier, key supplier, and trying to aggregate up to a simple set of KPIs and a RAG status and an explanation.
Yeah.
And then pinning that accountability to one of the executive team members.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah. And it's interesting, isn't it, how that's developed where, you know, if you look back to an immature organization where procurement is not involved in the relationship between the supplier and the business, and there's been a push to involve procurement, and then you know it looks like it's just got in the way and prevented the you know being a barrier in that interface, and now you know we've got to get past that and focus on those key suppliers, those partners, and maximize the value that they can bring. So it's another change that needs to happen.
Yeah, and also not forgetting the critical suppliers as well. Oh boy.
Yeah.
Have I had my ears burnt with that one?
There's some painful lessons for everyone. And you know, and what you're talking about there is changing procurement's focus. You know, it can be very narrow. It can be just about the buying, you know, and then it's, you know, we've put a contract in place, we forget about it. But actually it's long term. It's managing a supply chain. It's managing whole life costs, the whole life cycle of a product. So again, it's, you know, as procurement becomes more mature, we've got to widen our perspective.
Yeah. And, you know, the leaders of the future and the teams of the future are those who actually get are process oriented, and they can think in terms of chunking the processes down and looking at the value chain and re-engineering that with suppliers and with the stakeholders, and actually, you know, optimizing efficiencies along the way, and really getting into longer term partnerships if that's required as a result of that. So the suppliers can learn, but also the business can too. And being very open and honest with those suppliers that generally will always be in the what I classify as the leverage category or the repetitive bidding category, simply because they're commoditized. And that is the competitive nature of the market. Mm-hmm. And we are going to auto bid, and we are going to maximize value. Mm-hmm. And being very honest and open about that. And if they do want to get into a strategic relationship with us, then they need to come to us for the reason why.
Yes. Yep.
And having the ability to listen to that. But when you get into strategic suppliers, it's almost they have to earn the right to be there and continue to be there.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you're getting to a point where you're coming up to potentially rebidding and the cost of change. And this is one of the biggest nightmares for me is, okay, so what's it going to cost to change then? What is the pain barrier? You know, a lot of businesses, they don't want to change because they get comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
They become embedded. The relationships become very connected. This is human behavior. It's quite normal. How do you convince an organization, not just from a price point perspective, but, you know, a value add and innovation and learning all over again with a new provider? How do you do that? And the backlash and the resistance is interesting, you know, from we can't possibly do that to what's the cost? How long will it take? What will we do? And being proactive about that and having teams ready with that information way in advance of the tendering mechanism to help the discussion.
Yep.
That's where you get that's where you fall short with the supplier relationships, because they lull you into a false sense of security along with everything else that's on the wheel, from normal operational procurement right through to getting ready for budgets. But you know, being ready with all of that detailed morass of information and having the systems to support you do that.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. In what is a very, very business strategic decision, you know, corporates will have a handful of, you know, strategic suppliers, critical suppliers, or what they might even consider partners. And, you know, very few organizations think in that way. You know, they still consider them to be still down in that leverage box, and or as you say, they're in a almost a panic situation of going, well, we can't change because we haven't got any alternatives. We've not thought it through.
We've not thought that through.
Yeah.
So, you know, the simple four-box matrix really does the trick. You know, which ones do you outsource, the tail of suppliers? Mm-hmm. Which ones do you keep close to, but keep that competitive tension going? And the control and balance of power between buyer and supplier, which ones are critical and are going to bring the business down if you don't watch out, mm-hmm. and which ones you just continually tender and leave as a consequence of the market.
Very good. Excellent. Let's just talk about one last thing, Kathy, if that's okay. So I wanted to just bring that discussion, which is fantastic, going down into each of those five areas, but just talking about the leadership aspect of the CPO, because that's the kind of glue that keeps it all together, all of those pieces that are moving, and the CPO, it's quite a role there. So I mean how do you see that, the role, what's the role of the CPO to deliver all of those things?
You know, I can divide this into technical skills,
mm-hmm.
and emotional intelligence,
mm-hmm.
and the more people management skills.
Yeah.
And I don't think a CPO would be in the position if they didn't have good technical gravitas.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what that's.
Yeah.
And they've managed large scale transformation. They understand, you know, the whole agenda. And I'm sure that's easily traced and tracked. But going forward, particularly in the uncertainty of today's environment and the challenges that employees are now bringing to the table, and the awareness that we're getting as leaders around disabilities, mm-hmm. diversity and inclusion, mental health issues, burnout syndrome, you know, the need for just, you know, some time to retrench and to think and take time out to digest the strategic agenda as well as the day-to-day agenda. Mm. So oftentimes you'll find leaders with lots of ability to think very laterally and very wide and then drill down into lots of detail and very narrow. So they're constantly moving between detail and broader perspectives. But it's been able to translate what the business needs mm-hmm. into what it means for individuals at the coalface, as you put it,
yes,
and on the ground, and being able to, you know, stop by someone's desk and say, what's your role in all of this? Did you really get it? You know, did that mission statement make sense to you? Did it sound like gobbledygook? How are you doing? How are you feeling? Is it too much? Taking the feedbacks, but on the more individual personal skill sets, I think it's about authenticity.
Yep.
Ultimately, just being real and sharing what the challenges are that you're facing and sharing that with the team. So by actually agreeing with them that it's tough, mm-hmm. agreeing with them it's been a tough year and there's more to come, mm-hmm. And getting their feedback about what can and can't be done and mm-hmm. when to say no and when to change operational and day-to-day activities from change activities. A leader has to listen, be taking feedback constantly, be open to challenge, mm-hmm. and literally just be willing to share. They call it productive vulnerability, but for me, it's just being authentic, being open, mm-hmm. and not sharing your woes and burdening your team. But, you know, trying to get a sense of what they understand your role is and what you're trying to achieve, mm-hmm. and how they've interpreted their role at the same time and their tasks.
Yeah.
If you're doing that, you're doing well.
Yeah. Great. Great.
You know?
That's great. That's a real insight into that leadership.
What do you think, Richard? I mean, have you seen what do you think the leaders are doing now?
What are we seeing the successful ones out there? They're able to work at all levels within the organization. So they were able to sit down with the chief exec and talk strategy. They're able to walk into the CFO's office and have an understanding of the numbers and the drivers behind those numbers. They're able to walk onto the shop floor and have a discussion about a particular part or a supplier service issue. As you say, you've then got to have that that emotional connectivity with every person in your team. It's quite a mix that's needed for a CPO.
It is, and it's more emphasis on the people, how they're feeling, the mood.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's really feedback, being kind.
Yeah.
Congratulating, celebrating, understanding issues, being transparent about that. Low on ego, high on curiosity.
Yeah. And of course,
I think it's a good one.
Yeah.
And fighting for your team, showing that you're not going to, go down without a fight in terms of having the difficult conversations with your peers. Not necessarily automatically saying, okay, it's a 25% headcount reduction and we're going to take it. And then explaining to the team why we need to work harder for the next 2 months, because we want to get the story right. And getting them involved in that story, but also giving them some time for downtime, one day a month reflection.
Absolutely. And this, of course, this is in the context of Dealing with, you know, supply chain issues, you know, supplier insolvencies, cost, you know, huge cost challenge, you know, rampant inflation. I know it's coming down. Inflation's still a positive. And of course, working conditions, you know, where everyone has been required to work from home, work hybrid. They're no longer able to perhaps fully, you know, fully share the challenges with their team members because they're working in their home offices.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's for too long there's been do more with less.
Yeah.
And it just seems to be, okay, we'll do more with less.
Yes.
There's the law of diminishing returns after a while. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for me, it's just about being able to say where you draw the line as a leader and what you're prepared to take as a budget.
Mm-hmm.
And have those discussions.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, but also, you know, having a real appetite for change, and oftentimes CPOs walk around with a lot of strategy in their head, mm-hmm. and they get it, so they have access to all the data.
Mm-hmm.
They understand, hopefully, the whole gambit of the business and what the business is trying to achieve, as well as procurement, and that's hardwired into their brain, and they walk and talk and eat it every day.
Mm-hmm.
But not everybody in the procurement team understands that or gets that.
Yeah.
And oftentimes it's having a management team around you that can decode
yes.
what you're thinking and what you're experiencing and yeah. communicating that down to them
yeah.
and saying, look, you know, this isn't some strange, you know, automaton in the background,
mm-hmm. yep.
you know,
yeah,
that is unapproachable. This is, you know, this is really what the strategy is about for this particular category of spend. And this is what it means. And having individuals around you at your management team that can act as almost like a transformer.
Yeah.
So I it's almost akin to being operating at 500 volts because you've got access to all the information
yeah.
and you need to transform down to 240 volts.
Yes. Yeah.
So having a leadership team around you that yeah. supports you in that and can help you with that, that's a must do.
Yeah. That's good. Yeah. Yeah, that's yeah. a great picture to paint of what's required, because that is, yeah. you know, that is what's required to make those big changes to, you know, to take a procurement function on that journey.
Mm. And each and every person will have a different experience of change. They have their different appetites for change. They have different fear factors around change.
Yeah,
and you know. I think being very clear and holding their hands metaphorically and giving them the tools
mm-hmm.
to go through change with is absolutely vital, you know?
Yeah.
Simple changes like we've got a new software,
mm-hmm.
we've got a new system. We're going to allow you a certain amount of time to actually go and train on that system
yeah.
and help you train your stakeholders on that system. This is basic stuff, but oftentimes it just gets lost in translation.
Yeah.
Right through to, you know, learning the latest techniques in AI and getting out there and spending time with their suppliers and with their stakeholders about the future.
Yes.
Oftentimes you get, you know, teams that are too down in the weeds and too bogged down with the operational tasks and the paperwork,
yeah.
even though it might be automated, the subsequent paperwork or mm-hmm. spreadsheets that need to be done or, you know, yeah. interpretations that need to happen. And they're not given enough time to do that. And that's where the burnout comes from and the loss of appetite for the role.
Yeah, yeah. And that comes back to the CPO's role to manage that, to allow those spaces for that to happen.
Mm. And oftentimes you can be blindsided. I've been there when, you know, you think you've cascaded the objectives and the goals down into the team. You think they've got it.
Yeah.
You think they're okay with it. Until you actually test it, or rumblings come back from in a different way and shape and form.
Yeah, yeah, that's it. Yeah. And you see that some of the best leaders are one of their core skills is communication, and they communicate and over communicate because it's so key, you know, to get mm. the fundamentals right.
And oftentimes when change requires external resources to come in,
mm-hmm.
Then you've got a different dynamic. So you've got a team within a team within a team.
Yeah.
You know, and people often get stir crazy around that as well, because Who are these new members? What are they doing here? How's it going to affect my role? How am I going to get on with my day job? I want to be doing that role because it seems more sexier to do that. Why can't I be backfilled and I can get to do the more strategic change roles? So you've got constantly this need to understand and critique and profile your skill sets and your people and constantly understand what their appetite is for growth and their promotional prospects and, you know, how are you going to actually sustain an organization should your attrition move to higher than the average of 13%? You know, if I was at 13%, I'd be feeling a bit twitchy. It's nice to get below 10 if you can.
Great.
But if you start to see that notch up, it's often an indicator that people just don't feel comfortable with.
Yeah. And that could be that you're just pushing a little bit too hard, or it's not quite clear where are you going? What the end goal is?
You know, Richard, oftentimes, you know, there's no perfect guideline to this. When is enough enough? How far do I press? How far do I push and why? Particularly if the CPO is being pushed and pressurized by the executive team. And rightly so. You know, how calm can a CPO be and how vulnerable can they be and how open can they be with all of these tensions and pressures and only release what's appropriate to help calm individuals down and get them through the change? That's often the most difficult thing to do of all, you know? And that's certainly been my personal challenge. Just because I can feel comfortable on doing 12 hours a day doesn't mean to say everybody else does.
Great. Kath, thank you. That is incredibly insightful into that leadership role, because it does come down to that, you know, it's a tough job. The CPO is a tough job.
Oh, my goodness. It's a tough gig. It really is a tough gig, because you have to be, you know, you have to be a jack of all trades and master of none. You have to be broad as well as deep in terms
deep.
Of you have to be personable, have great communication skills, be sensitive, empathetic, the ability to inspire and to motivate, to take accountability, to be respected, not necessarily liked, because not everybody can like you, but they can respect what you're doing and how you're doing it and why. And giving the team access to stakeholders and access to the executive, being given the accolades for the work that they are doing, because you are leading a team. Without the team, you are nothing. And so it is really them at the end of the day that makes the real difference. And, you know, to be proud of them, it's almost like a family at the end of the day, one should aspire to. But not too much infighting.
Oh, brilliant. Great. Okay, that's fantastic. I'm going to ask you a few quickfire questions just to finish up, which is what we do with all the guests on the show. So, you know, everyone gets asked this, but how did you get into procurement?
I started off life as a research chemist, and then I decided I wanted to be closer to the commercial side of a business. So I took up a procurement role.
Did you know what it was when you took the job?
Well, I did, because I took on almost a bridging role between research and procurement. So I became almost the interpretation arm for research. And it was in a chemicals organization that I did that. And then I got into electronics, again, as an operational role. But I wasn't satisfied with this concept of just-in-time and strategic relationship management. It didn't do what it said on the tin, even though, you know, at the time it was leading edge, it wasn't strategic enough for me. And I jumped into consulting and stayed in consulting for 14 years. And became a managing partner. And the discipline was procurement and supply chain. And I worked across public and private sector, nationally and internationally, making major change programs and business transformation, cost improvement, organization redesign, governance, all that good stuff. And specialized in defense as well, which was an interesting time. Decided I wanted to experience life on the other side of accountability. So I took on an executive role, a couple of CPO roles, and a non-executive role for the Ministry of Defense and DE&S. And now what I'm doing is I'm actually a board advisor. I'm a non-exec director. I do actually fractional interims, so I'll perhaps offset C-suite members 1 or 2 days a week in terms of strategy. If they're overburdened with operational roles, I might take some of their operational tasks away from them. I do a procurement interim as well. And I do think it was an interesting choice to begin in management consulting and bring all those skills over into an executive role and experience being a chief procurement officer in the cut and thrust of public sector life, which was challenging. They said it couldn't be done. Taking a team into a world-class status, which I was able to do with the team, which was a very proud time for me at the Royal Mail. Mm. And then having the benefit and you know, the joy of advising boards and giving them an insight from my experience, and obviously seeing it from both sides of the fence. So I've been on the other side of the CPO, and I understand the challenges, and I'm able to give them some advice and counsel. I also do volunteering work, and I've managed the art of work-life balance. So I volunteer in palliative care.
Great.
And I'm also a freeman of the Worshipful Company of Educators in London. So I get involved in advancements in education.
Yes.
Particularly about leaders of the future and what that means.
Yeah.
And how we educate and develop our children.
Yeah.
And I'm also an advisory board member for Breaking Barriers Innovations, which looks at socioeconomic issues in the UK around social housing, health, and infrastructure.
Yeah.
So I've got a blend now, which is it's a far better place to be. And you know, it's putting to the test 30 years of experience.
Yeah, that's good. So with all of that in mind, so what would you recommend to somebody who's developing their career in procurement?
Apart from take a deep breath. First one would be curious, you know.
Yeah.
Learn to really enhance your people skills. So if you enjoy collaborating with people, being curious, looking into innovation, if you like data, if you don't mind confrontation, if you're good at selling, and if you're good at analytics, and you've got a process orientation, and you want to be able to access all parts of a business, procurement, the future of procurement is good. So what would I advise? I'd say that it's well worth the effort once you actually embed yourself and establish yourself as an advocate.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes you have to learn to deal with the knockbacks on a day-to-day basis.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, keep pushing on that closed door.
Yes.
Because it will open. If you've got the right sponsorship and the right approach with the right data, you will open doors. It can be such a rich experience in terms of travel, in terms of the type of people that you meet, in terms of how you can see a business grow and your impact on it. You can actually get involved in all sorts of issues outside of work that relate to procurement and bring that back into the fore, you know, like volunteering, for example. Mm-hmm. You might get involved in sustainability outside of work and bring that back into the workplace. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's a real sociable network of great people who have a sense of humor.
Yeah.
Who know how to party hard and work hard.
Yes.
And I think there's just some really profoundly capable individuals out there who would benefit from a stint in procurement.
Yeah.
If they don't want to stay in it long term, fine. But just to understand what purchase to pay and the cycles in that really are, and how they can make a difference to a business in terms of its
profit. Just how important it is to a business.
Yeah, that's
great. I mean, I'm biased, but that was a pretty good sales pitch for the profession.
I rolled into it by accident, really. For me, I just found that commercial activities, negotiating, deep, complex contracts, preempting requirements, managing and envisaging the future, and then driving it through. There's nothing more, encouraging than that for me. This is what I live for, and watching two sides of the argument come together in unison and conflict being resolved. Yeah. That is what I enjoy as well. Interpreting suppliers' needs and being their advocate, and actually getting a board to understand what their needs are, because ultimately CPOs can actually decode for a business.
Yeah.
When it's struggling.
Yeah. Great.
Be their go-to point. So for me, I think it's a very worthwhile profession. I think it's a fabulous education process. You get dipped into all sorts of things and aspects of businesses that you wouldn't necessarily think about. Mm-hmm. And it's a really good springboard into alternative, broader horizons in business. So mergers and acquisitions is what I've got involved in, startups and so on, just simply through the springboard of procurement.
Yeah, great, brilliant. And Kath, so who should be our next podcast guest and why? There's the question.
Well, I thought about one and I had to come up with four.
Okay.
Because I couldn't decide on one. So my top four are Jennifer Masseri, Google. Mm-hmm. She's got $260 billion of revenue to manage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the whole AI automation regime and supply innovation and collaboration agenda that she's managing successfully. Yeah. It'd be really interesting to see what's on her agenda for 2024. On the podcast. I'd love that. Jackie Rock, she's just the new commercial director for the NHS. Yes. Got over 80,000 suppliers and £35 billion of spend. Now, she's entering a very complex change environment. Mm-hmm. So for her, the challenge is all about the change, case for change, and moving forward in a very decentralized environment and a very complex one. Al Williams, Barclays, steady state, reached a high degree of maturity. And on that basis, what is next for him in terms of value?
Yes. Where do you go?
And where do you go from that? Tufan Erginbilgic, the CEO of Rolls-Royce, and his CPO. I'd really love to get this together as a duo. Mm-hmm. Because Tufan has tripled the share value since he joined Rolls-Royce whilst going through a cost reduction process and increasing product price at the same time. So it'd be interesting to see how that duo have worked through that.
Okay. There's four. The next four podcast guests. Okay. There's a challenge.
I think it would be lovely, but it'd be interesting to get a range of CPOs who are struggling at the very beginning of the change cycle and those that have accomplished at steady state.
Yes, absolutely.
And what all of those in between.
Yeah, what a round table that would be, those four. That would be interesting.
It surely is.
Yeah. Oh, Kath, that's great. And thank you so much for your input. That's delightful. Just one last question for you. So, people that want to talk to you, where and how can they get in touch with you?
Well, I'm on LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. I'm regularly on LinkedIn, so you can catch me there.
Great.
Or you can catch me on kathleenharmison.co.uk. That's my website. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure take part in the discussion. We could have talked a lot longer.
I'm sure we will now. Yes, yeah, Kath, thank you. Thank you. That's brilliant.
Thank you, Richard. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you for joining us on the Procurement Initiative Leaders podcast. I really hope you enjoyed it. Looking for more procurement insights, tips, and developments from leading procurement professionals? Join our Procurement Initiative community on LinkedIn. Just open LinkedIn and search for the Procurement Initiative, and be sure to hit that subscribe button to never miss another episode. Thank you for listening.